Good morning, all. Let's get started. We have a very tight schedule today, and Representative Magnus asked to be put on the schedule today because he has folks up from his district, and I want to make sure we get to his bill. I didn't say that.
He knows he's got it.
Okay. We will start with the Metropolitan Council Parks and just to hear a quick introduction of the parks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Arnie Steffried. I'm a planning analyst in the Parks Program at the Metropolitan Council. I'll cover four topics for you today. First, I'll summarize the regional park system, explain to you what it is. Second, I'll present the governor's budget recommendation for operations and maintenance of the park system. Then I'll focus on why state funds are needed, and I'll conclude with how those funds benefit the state. The Metro Parks Act that was established in 1974 authorizes the Metro Council to identify land and grant funds to cities, counties, and special park districts to acquire, develop, and manage parks, trails, and special recreation features. Those parks and trails, together with state land, should reasonably meet outdoor recreation needs of the residents and visitors of the metro area. The dark blue areas on this map illustrate those state and federal lands. The regional trails, based on the legislative directive, there are 44 regional parks and 13 park reserves that have been identified in the last 32 years. The red regional parks range in size from 200 to 500 acres with a minimum of 100 acres. The Lake Harriet Band Shell is an example, and the land around those lakes is an example of a regional park. They include facilities for picnicking, boating, swimming, and trails. The green park reserves range in size from 1,000 to 5,000 acres, and 80% of that land is set aside and restored to native habitat for plants and animals. Park reserves have similar outdoor recreation facilities as regional parks, but they also have campgrounds and nature centers. Examples of such park reserves are the Rice Creek Channel Lakes in Anoka County and Mesa Ravine in Dakota County. Regional trails provide hiking and biking opportunities, as well as inspect line skating opportunities, plus green space that link these parks together. There currently are 177 miles of trails open to the public. These trails are shown in blue, along with the 17-mile Gateway State Trail in Ramsey County and Washington County, and the Loose Line State Trail in suburban Hennepin County. The red and tan lines constitute 700 miles of planned trails to be developed in the future. Special recreation features, which are shown in pink, are unique facilities that attract a regional and statewide audience. One example is the Marjorie McNeely Conservatory at Como Park. Other special recreation features include the Como Zoo, as well as Square Lake in Washington County. In total, there are 52,600 acres of parkland currently open for public use. The Metropolitan Regional Park System is not owned by the council, but rather by 10 regional park agencies shown on this slide. Staff from those agencies are here to answer any questions we have about their portion of the park system. Most of these agencies also own and manage non-regional park facilities that serve neighborhoods. Those local parks are not part of the regional park system, and we're not proposing funding for those in this appropriation. To ensure that the state's capital investment the recommendation by the governor is that $15.74 million be appropriated coming biennium, and of this amount, $6.6 million would be out of the general fund and $9.14 million of the lottery in lieu of sales tax revenue. The use of the regional park system is measured by visits has grown by 5.7% annually since its inception in 1974. This growth rate is faster than the population growth rate and is expected to continue into the future. These parks and trails provide close-to-home outdoor recreation opportunities as called for in the State Comprehensive Outdoor Recreation Plan. Since 1974, the state has provided $276 million in funds for the capital improvements to the parks, as well as land acquisition, and the Metro Council has provided $150 million for land acquisition and capital improvements. for a total of $426 million. It's therefore appropriate for state funds to help fund partially the operation and maintenance of these parks to ensure that the state's capital investment is protected. State funds are needed because the Metro Regional Park System serves a regional and statewide clientele. There were 33.4 million visits to the park system in 2005. 59% of those visits are by persons living within the jurisdiction that owns and manages that park unit. For example, a person who lives in the city of St. Paul that visits a regional park managed by the city of St. Paul is a local visitor. However, there's another 34% of the visits by persons living outside that park agency's jurisdiction, but within the seven-county metro region. For example, an Anoka County resident visiting a regional park managed by Washington County would be considered a non-local visitor. Plus, there are 3% folks from greater Minnesota that visit these parks, and 4% are from outside the state. And when you look at those numbers, if it's 33.4 million visits, 4% or 1.2 million people come from outside the state to visit the parks, and about 990,000 visits are by persons from greater Minnesota. Only the Mall of America has more visits per year than the park system. So why are state funds needed? Since 1985, the legislature has recognized that the regional park system is regional because it serves not only persons who live in one park agency's taxing jurisdiction, but many other people as well. As mentioned, over 40% of the visits to the system are by persons living outside the host park agency's taxing jurisdiction. That regional and statewide use of the system justifies some state funding to help operate and maintain it. Furthermore, park visitors therefore pay a proportional amount, if you will, for the use of their system by including state funding as well as local funding to operate and maintain the park system. The governor's recommended appropriation would fund 7.9% of the projected cost to operate and maintain the park system for fiscal years 2008 and 2009. That 7.9% is broken down into two components, 3.3% from the state's general fund and 4.6% from the lottery and the sales tax account. The remaining 92.1% would be financed with a combination of property taxes collected by the park agencies and by park user fees. The property tax contribution and the park user fee contribution is set by each agency for their own budget. To put the governor's $15.7 million biannual recommendation into context, this chart illustrates the amount of state funding provided in relationship to the total cost to operate and maintain the park system. The red area represents the state funds appropriated since fiscal years 1986-87 and what is proposed to and what has been proposed for 2008-09. The green area represents the total expenses to operate and maintain the park system. On average, state funds have financed about 9.4% of the cost to operate and maintain the park system. Your packet includes a table as of Metro Regional Park System operations and maintenance state appropriations 1985 to 2006. It breaks down the state appropriations by year and shows the percent those appropriations finance the total O&M expenses. The governor's recommendation for fiscal year 2008 and 9 continues a flat trend regarding state support since fiscal year 2000 and 2001. The growth in total O&M expenses of 7.3% a year is due to increased park user revenues from visitation growth, which, as I mentioned before, is 5.7% a year, and additional property tax revenues from the increase in the tax base. To conclude, the governor's recommended budget of $15.74 million to partially finance operations and maintenance of the park system will, one, help fairly allocate the cost to operate and maintain that system among those who benefit, maintain the state's funding level from the previous biennium, and three, help protect the state's substantial capital investment in the park system by helping to maintain it. That concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about this overview.
Thank you. We are going to hold questions until after Representative Scalzi presents her bill, because some of the questions may be answered as she does her presentation. But we do appreciate your coming and hope you can remain through her presentation to answer questions. Representative Scalzi, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Ms. Chair and members of the committee. Yes, I would
like to move House File Number 834 for possible inclusion into the Environment Finance Bill. And I have here with me today, I have Bob Bierscheid from the St. Paul Parks and Recreation System and also John Vondelini from the Anoka County Park System. And just to introduce some comments here, the governor's budget, as you've heard, is $3.3 million out of general funds, and my bill is for $5 million. It's an increase. We've had flat funding. The state law that implements the metro regional parks, which are in effect state parks, indicates that 40% of the state park regional park funding should come from the state. And we're right about 9.2% for operations and maintenance this year. So therein lies the problem and the reason that we have the bill to increase it to $5 million. But with that, I'll introduce, I'll let Bob Bierscheid talk about his presentation.
Thank you, Representative Scalzi. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Bierscheid, and I'm Director of Parks and Recreation for the City of St. Paul. While I represent St. Paul, we are also one of the 10 agencies throughout the metro area who are responsible for managing, maintaining, and growing a regional park system throughout this area. We encourage your support of this bill of $5 million towards operation and maintenance of this unique park system that is critical to the lives of millions of Minnesotans. As was stated before, state statute provides that 40% of our metro parks operation and maintenance may be funded by the state of Minnesota. The purpose for that law was to address the fact that our parks have many more users than just within our local jurisdiction, and the state made a commitment to recognize its role in maintaining that system. Currently, approximately 7.9% of our operations and maintenance costs are met by the state, not the 40% intended. In fact, the state has never contributed more than 10% to our operations and maintenance when state law, again, allows for 40%. The $5 million we are requesting today, in fact, only represents inflationary costs since the funds were drastically cut in 2001. I want to point out this is critical. The purpose of these funds is to meet the day-to-day costs of maintaining and operating the Metro Park system. It is important to realize the difference. In Mr. Thepru's slide presentation before, he put up a slide that, and I want to reference that, in this particular slide, and it shows that where it talks about $15.74 million per biennium, and it references the lottery and lieu money. Now, that money is used differently. The money that we're talking about, the $5 million we're asking for, is the day-to-day maintenance. This is the garbage collection, the security, the general operation of the park, not the capital maintenance improvements that the lottery and lieu money is used for. Other programs are helping to fund the acquisition and major costs, but this, again, is specifically for operation and maintenance. We are very concerned about providing an affordable and accessible metro park system for the health and welfare of all of Minnesota citizens. There are several other representatives of the other agencies here, but at this time I'm going to ask John Vondelandi from Anoka County Parks to talk about some of the specifics on how we use this money for maintenance.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is John Vondelandi, and I'm the Director of Parks and Recreation for Anoka County, and thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning on House File 834. In the interest of time, I won't reiterate what Mr. Stepford and Mr. Bierscheid have already stated. However, I do want to emphasize the importance of this bill in providing for the adequate operations and maintenance of the recreational lands and facilities that make up the regional park system. Anoka County, where I am from, is representative of a growing suburban area with public pressures to expand outdoor recreational opportunities and facilities throughout our regional park and trail system. In the past 10 years, the use of the Anoka County park system, like the system as a whole, has grown by about 50%, and we currently have 2.8 million visitors per year to the Anoka County system. This growth has really been driven by two factors. One is just the sheer population growth of Anoka County, coupled with an increase in the number of non-county visitors, who now make up about 45% of the total county use of our system, who come to our county to enjoy our trails, campgrounds, water recreation features, and other facilities. This has created a demand to expand the number and location of facilities, and we appreciate the support that this committee has provided in the past to provide capital bonding and LCMR funds for the expansion of our system, but we've had to respond with an appropriate level of operations and support functions as well to maintain, program, provide public safety, customer service, and natural resources management for this expanding system. As Mr. Bierscheid said, these demands are being placed on all 10 of the regional park implementing agencies, who collectively will be expected to provide adequate outdoor recreational opportunities to 1 million new residents in just the next 20 years. At the same time as these use pressures are increasing, we are also, unfortunately, witnessing a general decline in the level of state and regional support for operations and maintenance of regional parks. You should have a handout that shows funding, general funding support over the years, and how we've seen in the last 7 years a decline in the current level of funding to a level now today of 3.8% of total costs. The result of this trend is that many of the services that we provide have been greatly scaled back or eliminated. In Anoka County, for instance, we've witnessed a reduction in our building facility hours at the Bunker Hills Activity Center. We no longer are open on evenings and weekends, for example. We've eliminated many of our park ranger personnel in the Anoka County park system. In some parks, we don't have park rangers operating on a regular basis. We currently have 2 unfunded vacancies for maintenance personnel, and we have removed our lifeguards services from all of our beaches in the county. In an effort to reverse this trend and to bring funding in closer alignment with the original state funding target of 40%, this bill will increase funding to $5 million, or about 5.8% of total regional park operations and maintenance costs. And this will be a very, very positive step for the regional park system. In an effort to illustrate the outcomes of this increased funding, each park implementing agency has submitted information on how it would utilize the additional dollars to accomplish efforts to increase and improve our operations and maintenance in the regional park system. And copies of those that handout was also provided to the committee. The common thread that runs through all of the agencies is the desire to restore funding for programs and services, to fill vacant staff positions, to reopen facilities, and to get our equipment and other maintenance programs back online. And there's no question but this added funding will be a significant boost for the regional park system and will create real outcomes that have immediate and lasting benefits for the citizens of the state and the metropolitan area. And while it doesn't fulfill the original funding target of 40%, it is significant nonetheless. In summary, it is my belief that the economic, environmental, social, and public health related benefits that will accrue from this bill will make this investment a wise decision for the state. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'll stand for any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Well, members, we have about 2 minutes left for questions, and what I'm going to suggest is we'll take those 2 minutes, and then beyond that, we have been receiving written comments from agencies, and I received a packet today, which I'll be sharing with you as soon as we can get them copied. If you have questions, you can give them to me or to Representative Scalzi, and we will get them to the appropriate people, including Mr. Steffrud. But with that, are there any questions to start with right now? Well, seeing any questions, thank you all for coming. And members, if you do have questions as you're thinking about this, please let us know, because we will send them out.
And I would just like to say in closing that, you know, nothing shows the system like a chart. And when you look at this chart and you see the upward trend and the cuts in 2001 and then the flat funding since 2001, and yet the extreme growth, it's 5.7% per year. And it's not like it's only metro regional people using these parks. To reinforce what Mr. Steffrud said, there's 900,000 visits from outstate Minnesota, outside the metro, and there's 1,200,000 visits from outside of Minnesota. So the metro regional parks are really providing a service to the state, and I would hope that we can help them out a little bit and help them maintain their parks.
Thank you. I have opened mine to the same chart. I think it is the right chart. With that, we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Representative Small, you are next.
Good
previous set of cards that destroys the computer and
No, I think that probably belongs to the governor too, and we were going to be super.
Well, it belongs to
super
the,
careful.
It belongs to all of you.
Oh,
it's public property. I'll be very careful. This one is unplug it from the camera, and that should work fine.
Get out of your way.
I think the sooner the testimony is done, the sooner we'll get to the question.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks. Thank you for your time. Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 544, but I also have a small oral amendment.
Yep.
On line 1.5, it's $5 million per year. And on 1.12 is $4 million per year.
And that is an author's amendment, which we can incorporate. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 544 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Environment Natural Resource Bill. I will be quick because the testifiers have more pressing things to say than me. And I think this really dovetails on Representative Scalzi's testimony. Previous legislatures before us have made wise, very forward-thinking investments in our state natural resources. And in fact, many in this committee have worked for years to establish our state park system and to establish our state trails. And in my estimation, I think many people would agree with this, Minnesota is the envy of the United States in the commitment we've made to our parks and trails. It's part of our way of life. It's an important economic development tool. Natural resource-based tourism is the number one employer in northern Minnesota. We would like to keep it that way and to grow. The challenge for us, however, is that while we have these fantastic parks trails, we are not maintaining them. And we'll, right in this committee and next year in the bonding bill, we will spend a good deal of time arguing and working out how we're going to establish additional trails and perhaps new visitor centers and other things in our state parks. Yet in the very parks and trails that we currently have, we're not staffing them properly. Many of them are closed when visitors want to attend. And in fact, the very trails that we have recently built here are almost unusable because of erosion of the trail, grass growing up, shoreline erosion, other things that really prohibit us from using the wise investment that we've made in years past. So with that, I'd like to introduce who all of you know, Judy Erickson, who's the mastermind behind this legislation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, committee members. My name is Judy Erickson, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the Parks and Trails Council. And on behalf of our members across the state, appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And thank you, Representative Moe, for all of your hard work on this legislation, and many of you on the committee who have worked with us in the past, and we look forward to working with you this year as well on this issue. Just a word about who the Parks and Trails Council is. We are a grassroots membership organization, and we've been around for more than 50 years, and we've worked on protecting, expanding, investing in our parks and trails system for our public's enjoyment for now and for in the future. We have, as an organization, been instrumental in adding more than 8,700 acres of land to state parks, valued at over $11 million. And that's money that we revolve. We buy, we turn it over, and we revolve that money into other projects. But while we do have an active land acquisition program, we also believe it is very important that we take care of the investment that Minnesota has made in its state parks and trails, and that's why we are here today. We do have one of the oldest state park systems in the United States. Itasca was established in 1895. Today, Minnesota's 72 state parks and recreation areas protect over 261,000 acres of land. They're some of our most treasured landscapes, scenic vistas, and cultural resources. There are 523 miles of state trails, that links ecosystems, communities, parks, and people together and provide opportunities for our citizens to be healthy and active. But as we have been talking about and as you have discussed when you're in your DNR budget overviews and everything else, general fund expenditures for our state parks and our trail system and for all of our environment natural resources is at an all-time low. And that is something that we hope we can work with you to turn around this year. In the interest of time, I won't make the pitch about how Minnesotans value their parks and trails because we know you understand that. Today, we are talking about the future and what the opportunities we have to provide for the future of our state park and trail system. Not, we can talk about the past and what's been lost, but today let's talk about the future and where do we want what our future to look like for our state parks and trails, for our children and our grandchildren. And so as we move forward, we look forward to working with you on where we want to invest these funds, and we'll talk about that later. But I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm glad to be here. My name is Dave Simpkin.
Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you. And I'm the editor of the Trails Magazine. I think you have a copy of our winter edition in your packets. And I'm here to say we are not taking care of that investment of this beautiful jewels we have in Minnesota. You know, when I was a student at the University of Minnesota, I studied the trucker strike of 1934. And there was a rabble-rousing leader that spoke to over several thousand people on Chicago Avenue. And said, the day will come in the state of Minnesota when every working family will have a place at the lake. It was interesting, in that time, in the heart of the Great Depression, we built some wonderful facilities in our state parks that are standing today. Stone log buildings that are just testimonies to the commitment. But here, in the day of affluence, we can't cut our grass, and we're not trimming our trees the way we should in these beautiful parks and trails. Right? As I go out, I have a really wonderful job. I get to go out to all the state parks and on the trails and interview people. One person I recently interviewed was a woman by the name of Evelyn Moyer, 90-year-old botanist. And her husband published guides for flowers, wildflowers in Minnesota. She was on the Nicollet Trail part of a reunion with her old Girl Scout troop. And they were hiking up a trail looking at flowers. But they were stopped by a tree that had fallen on the trail. A tree that had been there for a couple of years. And they had to turn around and go back to the Douglas Lodge. You know, we're putting roadblocks into people's way. It doesn't take much to cut a tree down. I talked to staff, and staff said, well, we don't have money for maintenance. So, as I go to state park, I always like to follow the naturalists, because they tell a story, they tell a great story. And when I do that, I always look, I get my camera, I watch the children. And recently in November, I went on a naturalist trip in Itasca about winter in the wilderness. And I'll never forget the picture of this 8-year-old girl I got. And the naturalist was showing her the claw of a rough grouse and how it's sort of feathered in the bottom because it serves as a snowshoe. And that kid was just amazed. Minnesota poet Robert Bly says, the best way to maturity is through nature. The more and more urban we become as a society, the more and more important nature becomes. Our naturalists become. Our state parks become. You know, we need to take care of those investments. You see this woman on our cover? At a rollerblader, she paid $1,500 to come from Buffalo, New York, to rollerblade on an organized tour of Minnesota. I interviewed the tour guide. He says, yes, Minnesota has the best paved trails in the nation. We bring groups here 3 times a year that are willing to pay $1,500 to blade on our trails. I said, hey, what's your favorite trails you go on? Oh, my favorite trail is the Root River Trail. But we don't go there anymore. It's too beat up. It's too dangerous. I won't take the risk. You know, we're putting roadblocks in people's way. Okay? If you look at the magazine that you handed out there, you go through our magazine, you'll see a lot of advertising, which is a good thing. But most of those advertisers are ma and pa businesses. Tourism is a $10 billion industry in Minnesota. But in Ely, in Pawtucket, in Hackensack, in Lanesboro, it's the difference between profit and loss. I have a customer in Garfield, Minnesota, JoJo's Cafe. And she was about ready to shut down her cafe in a little town of Garfield. She said, I'm going to wait a year to see how this trail does. That's 3 years ago. She now has a bike rack on the side of her cafe. And she's in a very popular destination for people who love big, hearty breakfast after you've been biking. Our trails are important. The last person I want to introduce you to is a man by the name of Clifford Gromenschenkel, a retired farmer from Melrose. And he has a little townhouse in Melrose. And I was speeding down Lake Wobegon Trail one morning, pedaling away, and here I see this electric wheelchair. And there was Clifford with a hydrogen bottle, you know, between his legs, and a breather thing in his nose, and a pair of binoculars. And every morning he says he comes out to watch the Orioles. Now the day will come where maybe you and I will be in that little wheelchair. And I think we're going to want a trail that's well maintained so we can get out and see the Orioles. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Scott Harrison, and I'm wearing two hats here this morning. Number one, I'm the owner-operator of the company that bought the Lutzen Resort, Minnesota's oldest resort, from the Nelson family. We've operated that for 19 years. And given the experience we've had this winter, there are some days when I feel like I've been there since 1881, when the Nelsons came. We are the second largest private employer up in that area. My second hat that I'm wearing today is I'm board member, treasurer, and on the executive committee of Lutzen Tofte Tourism Association, which represents 52 businesses in our end of the county. And believe me, given the population up there, that's all of them. I'm here today because of concerns of lack of reinvestment in our state parks and also to talk a little bit about the impact of the margins or the impact that the state parks have on the margins and operating revenues at our businesses. On the public side, Cook County has got 91% of its area in the public domain, and you're probably well aware of that, between the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, Superior National Forest, and state parks. So on the private side, it's only 9%. From Gooseberry to the Canadian border, we have 8 state parks. We have a state park every 12 miles from Gooseberry up to the Canadian border. The state parks in our area have visitor use, which is 2.5 times that of the average elsewhere in the state. They are critical to our guests, and the handout that I gave you certainly illustrates how gorgeous they are and justifies that. On the private side, if you look at the last page of the handout, as someone that used to teach corporate finance at the University of Minnesota Duluth and now lives and breathes and suffers from those margins and represents those other 51 businesses that have the same, I just point out on that last chart, if you look at the CPI-adjusted total revenues for our county, it has been absolutely flat since 1991. Now, if you take that into account and assume the CPI has been maybe 2.5 points a year, and to look at the cost of doing business, which is growing 4, 5, and 6% a year, there is no question in my mind that all of our business up there have shrinking margins. If you look at the line below that, you'll see the total revenues from the parks and how strong a correlation that is. The other thing I'd like to mention on the private side, because of our concerns of shrinking margins, we paid for a study, Lutzen Tofte Tourism Association paid for a study last year from UMD that asked our guests that have been up there the most significant value contributors to their stay and what was most relevant to them returning. And one of the things that jumped out at me, and I hadn't been previously aware of how significant it was, is the beauty of the state parks and the need to reinvest in that infrastructure. In Cook County, unlike the rest of the counties, much more so, the average in the state is about 15% of leisure spending in all counties in the state. In Cook County, it is 50. It is easily the highest in the state. 33% of all of our residents are using state parks. 29% of all Minnesota people bike. We need, both on the private side and the public side, we need to reinvest in our state parks. We need to reinvest for our future, for our current citizen use, and particularly to bolster the amenity, a significant one that it is, and keep that current for the private sector, which has been suffering for the last 7 years. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee member.
Thank you all for your testimony. I think you are speaking to an audience that is very receptive to your message. I think we all agree that this is a huge problem. We have only about 1 minute for questions.
I'm going to take 30 seconds of that.
Okay.
In your handouts, we know we're going to have to make some tough financial decisions in the legislature and in this committee in particular. And so we worked with the Department of Natural Resources to come up with what are the most immediate priorities in parks and trails funding. Where are we going to, what trails need improved? What facilities need infrastructure improvements, and what staff is going to have the most impact on Minnesota residents if we, in fact, restore staffing to previous levels. And so in your packet is a list of those most immediate needs and what they will cost and how we actually came up with the $9 million annually that this bill is asking for. And for Madam Chair, for you specifically, I know you've expressed an interest in naturalist programs, day camps. That is in here, and we will dramatically be able to increase the access for kids as their gateway opportunity into natural resources and the environment. We share that concern.
I don't see this in my packet, but we're going to make sure if it's not, we will get it around.
Sure.
It. Oh, it's inside here.
Madam Chair.
Okay. It's inside the magazine.
I got a comment.
So, is there any additional questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative
Hill. Well, I have a comment on this list. Notwithstanding something that I don't recall from a previous committee meeting, I think this list right here is an example of the type of outcomes that we are trying to understand, and this is very specific. I think your leadership, both before you became a chair and now as chair, has said we want to know the outcomes, and this is so outcome orientated and so easy to follow. I really appreciate this type of presentation.
So do I. Any other questions? Thank you all for coming, and I too thank you for this. This is what we need.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Next, we have Representative Loeffler. We are going to lay over, just for the record, we're laying over House Bill 544 for possible inclusion in the finance bill as amended. Thank you. Representative Loeffler, welcome to the committee. We are moving as fast as we can because we have a huge agenda today.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I will appreciate that. As someone who sometimes doesn't feel very articulate, I think sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words. And so I have a couple of visuals here, but I also wanted to say, if you think of a typical landscape in Minnesota, whether you're looking at lake country, a farmland, or even just a neighborhood city block, there's almost always a tree in that vision. But we tend to take them for granted. And we're going to try and make sure that we as a state and our local government partners don't take our trees for granted. The majority of the community forestry effort is property tax funded or paid for by property owners. State money has been used effectively by DNR to build local capacity, promote effective community forest management, and encourage sustained commitment. The relief program has traditionally been the other state-funded source of funding for tree planting and other tree activities, and because it's changing LCCMR funding for this year, it is not recommended for funding. So as far as I know, this is the only state funding of local government efforts. The bill before you applies to all cities, counties, townships, special recreation districts, and park and recreation boards in the cities of the first class. Sometimes when people see municipality, they don't see that broad a definition. If we need to, we can amend that into the bill. But it is all of our local governments who are eligible for this across the state. The environmental impact of our forests is, I think, underestimated. We have, once again, as a state, have some proud accomplishments that we can share with the rest of the world, in that the U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Service, the Pacific Southwest Research Station, and the Minneapolis Parks Forest Department actually engaged in a major-breaking scientific effort to calculate the value of trees, both economically and environmentally. A single tree can reduce 55,125 tons of carbon dioxide. I know you have been talking about global warming and carbon sequestration. It removes 2 pounds of air pollution, that's sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, particulates. You think of all the increasing metro air alerts that we've unfortunately been seeing in recent summers, and think about the impact of that. Each tree intercepts an average of 1,685 gallons of stormwater. So cities like Burnsville, Eagan, Maplewood have trees as part of their stormwater runoff management program. Two Harbors is protecting Lake Superior with its use of trees to retain rainwater. So they're a key component of our environmental protection service. What's even more important right now for us to nurture and sustain these local efforts in a time of tight budgets. We're not the only ones with tight budgets. You'll hear from a local mayor about how they're struggling to set priorities as well, is that we are still under threat by not only our existing tree paths like Dutch Elm, which is still marching through many areas, and oak wills. Gypsy moth is up on the North Shore, and the Ag Department is doing a good job so far of containing that. But we also have the new threat of emerald ash borer, and I've asked them to hand out this map that shows you how ash is a dominant tree cover in Minnesota. This is already on the East Coast. In Michigan, they have spent over $350 million in trying to eradicate emerald ash borer. Most of that has been going to taking down trees and destroying them and then replanting when they can. The U.S. Department of Agriculture just a few months ago issued a release in which they said the potential of emerald ash borer is to cost state and local governments $7 billion, that's with a B, over the next 25 years to remove and replace ash trees. The General Accounting Office did a big study of all the various different tree paths in 6 different areas of the country. Overwhelmingly, they started in an urban developed area, not in the forest where we have state forests and national forest management. They started in an urban or developed area. By the time they were detected, usually by a volunteer property owner who was just alert, and called attention to it, they realized it had been established in other areas. So our local government partners are our eyes and ears on the trees, not only in our state forests, but also in all of our cities throughout the state. Any money that you invest will be far stretched and invested wisely in keeping that local forest going. And with that, I'd like to have you hear briefly from Katie Huminga, who's the mayor of Lake City.
And before we hear from her, I would like to recognize Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to move. I don't believe we've moved House File 654. I'm a co-author with Representative Loeffler. And thank you, Representative Loeffler, for coming before us today. And, Madam Chair, I believe my motion would be to move it for possible inclusion in the environment omnibus finance bill. So with that, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 654 for possible inclusion in our finance bill.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. And if our guests would proceed, thank you for coming.
Good morning.
I can hardly see you through the tree leaves.
Yeah, let's move the tree in this case. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Katie Huminga. I am the mayor of the city of Lake City, and I am also a consulting urban and community forester. I've been a state-certified tree inspector since 1981, so I have watched the Dutch elm disease decimate forests in our throughout Minnesota, and I'm witness to the resurgence of Dutch elm disease just in the past few years. In addition, our community forests continue to be threatened by oak wilt and other diseases and pests. And every time we get a little bit of drought, we deal with problems, epidemic problems of pine beetle and oak chestnut borer and other sorts of problems. And it seems with global warming, all this does is escalate. What we are looking at now in our communities is down the barrel of a gun. And what is coming at us is emerald ash borer. You know, every year my city budget some funds from our very tight budgets for tree planting, tree care, and tree removal. We can't anticipate nor budget for something like emerald ash borer. Here's what's different. Emerald ash borer is likely to come to us probably with firewood that's moved improperly from an area that's infested, as an example. I don't know whose community it's going to hit first. Will it be my community? Will it be Minneapolis? Will it be Winona or Mankato? I don't know, but I know my community is at risk. We happen to have a campground, for example, right in town. As a forester, this is what I have to say to a community that has even one single tree become infested with emerald ash borer. I have to tell you that this winter you will cut down that tree, and you must cut down every ash tree, green ash, white ash, black ash, all the cultivars, every ash tree within 1/2 mile of that single infested tree. This is unprecedented. This will be more difficult than oak wilt, more difficult than Dutch elm disease, more difficult than anything that we've dealt with in my career in our communities. On behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities, I want to tell you that this is legislation that the League supports. We support funding that will assist cities in dealing with these sorts of problems in our communities. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak and encourage you to fund this, an important tool in our toolbox in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have been hearing about emerald ash borer, and I know it is a concern to committee members. Are there questions? Representative McNamara.
Madam Chair, I just, Representative Dill and I were having a question. Representative Loeffler, you specifically have targeted cities of the first class. It looks like you're ready to make a comment. Go ahead.
Yes. Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, I have actually in my opening remarks mentioned that the municipalities referred to online 1.7 includes all local governments, but I said that if you needed to you could make a clarifying amendment which would say and delete municipalities to indicate cities, counties, townships, special recreation areas. In our statutes, often in some areas in local government, we refer to municipalities as all local government. Sometimes we're more specific, and if the committee would want to make that, I could offer an oral amendment.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, as Representative Dill just said, that would be helpful, and I think that would be a good idea. So whenever it's appropriate, I don't know if you want to hear the rest of the testimony and then do it.
I think if you would offer that amendment now, Representative McNamara.
Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the amendment, and I would ask Representative Loeffler to repeat my amendment.
Great. On lines 1.7 and 1.11, delete municipalities and insert cities, counties, townships, special recreation areas. And that was always the intent, and that's the way DNR has always administered these programs to local government.
I would move that amendment, Madam Chair.
Does everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Frank.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I do have one other testifier who would like to be recognized just briefly, and that's Ralph Siebert, the Director of Forestry at Minneapolis. Thank you.
Thank you, Representatives. Just following up on...
If you could give your name for the record.
Sure. Ralph Siebert.
Mm-hmm.
Just to follow up on Mayor Humunga's comments regarding this bill, like many municipalities, Minneapolis benefited in the late 1970s from the grant program that was in place at that time to help control the spread of Dutch elm disease. And so to this date, we still have 30-some thousand American elms on our streets, which are adding all those benefits that Representative Loeffler mentioned. The difference for us, though, is even though we staggered our population of trees on the streets and added ash as one of those choices because it's been a good choice, we know now that we have 38,000 ash trees on our streets. And if you extrapolate some of the studies that have been done in Ohio where it's already got a good foothold, it'd be like about a $60 million project to just deal with the removal and the loss of the benefits and the replacement of those trees just in Minneapolis alone. And then when you go outstate to areas such as Moorhead, where ash is an even more important species because of the tough growing conditions out there, some of those smaller towns have a bigger problem in that ash, in some cases, composes a bigger population of all their trees. So we look at this as an investment that will help those places get a start, at least by knowing how many ash trees they have to begin with, so they can at least plan on what they're going to replace them with and get a start that way.
Are there any other questions from members?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to let the members of this committee know that this is really, really huge. We need this money for, whether it's in this bill, it's stated to be the DNR, and I believe it'll be a different bill coming before us to transfer from the Department of Ag, where it's currently administered, the Shade Tree Protection Program, to move to the DNR, and that's pretty well, for the most part, been widely accepted as looks like it's a good move. There's some controversy there. But, folks, we need to put some money in this program because this ash issue is huge. As the mayor said, this affects all varieties of ash trees. Dutch elm disease attacked American elm. For the most part, Chinese elm were not subjected to it. This is widespread. It will affect the swamp black ash in Representative Dill's district to the white ash varieties in southern Minnesota. This is huge, and we made the what looks like now the mistake of planting ash as the most predominant species in the 70s and 80s to replace the elm tree. And in retrospect, that maybe was a mistake. Though we planted many varieties, ash was the most popular. So I just hope, Madam Chair, that you'll see this committee. We need millions in a fund for the DNR or the Department of Ag, whoever it is, to deal with this if it pops up. Because the city of Lake City, we may point to the city of Minneapolis and say the park board could deal with it. In reality, I don't believe you can without help. But the city of Lake City or the city of Hastings, or unfortunately it could pop up on the North Shore in Representative Dill's district, Two Harbors doesn't have the ability to deal with cutting down all the black ash within a half a mile of a live tree, and the PR needed to convince people they need to cut down you don't know how traumatic it was to tell people they had to cut down dead trees. If we're going to tell them they got to cut down live trees, the tree inspectors better be well armed when they're making their visits, because the people are, they're in tears over a dead tree. I can't imagine the reaction of cutting down live trees. So thank you, Representative Loeffler. And Madam Chair, you do have challenges, as Representative Moe said, putting this budget together. And I just hope there's a way we can find a significant amount of money for this project.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming. We appreciate it. We have one more question. It's going to be very quick because we are having our eye on that.
Very quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Do we risk spreading the disease when we cut, split, stack, and burn for firewood?
Are you talking about emerald ash borer?
That's infested with emerald ash borer?
Yes, Madam Chair. By the time that wood has seasoned, the insects may have had an opportunity to complete their life cycle and travel to other locations. At this point, my understanding is there's a lot of research going on. Hopefully by the time it gets here we can refine the recommendations, but at this point you cut the tree down, you chip the tree, you pile the chips, you burn them. It never can go into a utilization stream except for the very core of the tree. Anything in the outside of the tree and the bark has to be completely destroyed.
Thank you
for that sobering message. Thank you. Next, we have Representative Saylor and Representative Gartner. Would you be so kind as to move House File 854?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 854, recommend it to pass, and refer to full Finance Committee, I believe, is where the next step would be.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Saylor. We are being cautious of our time. Representative Magnus has guests from out of town, and he asked to be put on the agenda today, and we are going to try to accommodate his guests.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Oh, excuse me, before we do that, we're going to lay House File 654 on the table for possible inclusion. I think that happened, but I want to make sure it's
okay.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, I am happy to be here, and we will try to move through this fairly briefly today since I think a lot of people are pretty well aware of the e-waste bill. And I would, okay, first of all, like to incorporate an amendment. I would like to move the H.O. 5483 amendment.
Okay, I will move that okay. For you, Representative Taylor. That is the A3 amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Members have it before them to get it in the shape the author would like it. All of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment has been incorporated.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I would just like to make a few explanations of the amendment for people very briefly. line 1.2 on page 6. We noticed as we were looking through the bill, reviewing it, that we had too many counties listed at one point, and we wanted to make sure that the 11-county metro area definition was consistent throughout the bill. And so basically what we did was help out the manufacturers a little bit in this case, and we were clarifying that it's only the 11-county metro area that is not getting the 1.5 on the collection. So that again is just, you know, some cleanup language. The rest, you know, 1.4 through 1.8 is again just some cleanup language that was recommended by the agency. Line 1.9, page 18. Just some cleanup language there that came as well from some of that was from the agency and also from Department of Administration. Line 1.12, again, that was from the Department of Administration wanting to clarify their own contracts. So these are not substantive changes, they're just cleanup and to keep the bill basically consistent as well with the companion bill moving through the Senate.
If you could give us a short summary of the bill, we can hear from the testifiers.
Yeah. Okay. And I will apologize in advance to everybody for my allergies. So hopefully I won't be coughing in your ears. Just briefly, what this bill does is it last year, the ban went into effect throughout the state of Minnesota, whereby video display devices, in other words, your dead computer screens and TVs, no longer could be thrown into the garbage or solid waste. And so for the last year, those have been collected. They couldn't go in the garbage. And the counties and cities have been collecting those. This bill sets a target for the amount of recycling that manufacturers are responsible for, and they're only responsible for a fraction of the weight of their new sales. They report their sales, and the bill started out as a 1-to-1 ratio, and it is no longer at that point. We have gone to a 0.8% ratio for the manufacturer's responsibility. And I'd also like to mention that this bill gives the manufacturers a lot of flexibility regarding how to meet the targets. They can partner with other manufacturers, partner with other trade associations, and with counties. This bill creates very little in the way of bureaucracy. The PCA registers the manufacturers, reviews a fee formula, and calculates sales based on national data. They're not picking through piles and piles of computers, nor are county solid waste folks. The manufacturers register to sell through a retailer starting August 1st of 07 and label their brands. The retailers will, by February 1st, check in with the agency's website and make sure that they understand the registration obligations. And there's an initial fee of $5,000, the registration fee from the manufacturers, but that's only for the first year. That goes down in the future because the first year is just designed to get the program up and running. It goes to $2,500 after that.
And as we try to keep this very brief, but basically they'll be bringing, they won't be collecting themselves necessarily, although there is an opportunity for them to do so. I think at this point we will have the testifiers come, because I know that you are interested in keeping this moving along. So I think I'll have Ted Trulene from St. Louis County.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Perkins.
As Mr. Trulene comes down, I was just going to make a note of one typo here, which I don't think we have to act on if I understand the rules correctly. On the A3 amendment, on line 1.9, it says page 18, and it should be page 8. I know we're working, Mr. Yes. Eloff, around the clock here, so no, don't worry about it.
We will incorporate that.
Yes,
amendment.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Trulene, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you this morning. I intend to keep my comments very brief. So I just, first of all, like to thank you on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Solid Waste Administrators Association, which both support this bill. I wish to speak with you this morning. We are passing around a letter from John Steiner, who is the president of the Solid Waste Administrators Association. Mr. Steiner was unable to attend today, but he lays out some points of that we're supporting with respect to the bill. Would like to note that the picture is taken from a ditch in St. Louis County, and I had the opportunity to go out with one of Representative Bill's constituents and pick these up out of the ditch. So, anyway. Thank you. We believe that this is an important issue on the county level. I think that's evidenced by the 100% return that we received on the e-waste survey that went out. It's been a major item for discussion with counties. I think in general, counties are very supportive of improved waste management. We've stepped to the plate on landfill abatement activities, development of recycling programs, development of household hazardous waste programs. It is our intention to work with manufacturers on this program, too, and we intend to work in partnership, do our part to make sure that this bill will be carried out successfully. We do support an ambitious program. We have concerns about ongoing illegal dumping. We have concerns about the amount of waste that are continued to be stored in households. I don't know if any of you saw, but a recent survey up at in Duluth at WLSSD suggested that one in three households in the Duluth area are currently storing these types of computer monitors and televisions that it is in waste form. They're not usable anymore, but they're storing them because they're concerned about cost, concerned about what to do with them. We're concerned about the 2009 changeover, and we think this bill will be very helpful for us with respect to addressing that changeover. And overall, we believe that this bill will help give our residents a good, convenient opportunity to appropriately manage this waste stream, appropriately manage televisions and computer monitors. And we appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I would like to have, I think, Trudy Richter with the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, if she just had a few comments. I know most of them have already been incorporated, but I will give her that opportunity. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. She would like to defer to Jim Kordiak, the Anoka County Commissioner.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, members. I am Jim Kordiak. I'm a county commissioner for Anoka County. I have been for about 20 years, and I think I've been working on this issue for about that time, some claim. But I will point out that I have been involved with this process for a long time. Today I'm speaking on behalf of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, which many of you know make up 6 of the 7 counties in the metropolitan area, handling a wide variety of waste issues. I chair that entity now. I also speak on behalf of AMC. Victoria Reinhardt isn't here today. She often is, but is gone today, but assured me that my comments mimic hers as well. But I have been a key proponent of this discussion for a long time. Minnesota actually began this discussion about 1995.
We chaired and led an initiative with governments and manufacturers across the nation talking about this issue. We spent about a year and a half or two exploring this. We had a lot of interesting and rewarding discussions, but didn't make any substantial progress in this matter. At the same time, there was a national initiative going on, which some of you may come to know as NEPSI, the National Electronics Product Stewardship Institute. I was on that entity, one of the only elected officials on about a 40-member board. About 20 were government and 20 were manufacturers. Very interesting discussions. After 2 years or 2.5 years of work, however, seeking a national solution to electronics, we kind of recognized that that was not going to prevail. Came back to Minnesota, if you will, and looking to solve that problem in this state, as have other states. There are about 4 states now that have electronic recycling as part of their national effort. Some of the things I might have said have been said. I will say, though, that this issue really is about the proliferation of e-waste. I don't have to tell many of you about that problem. You can look around the room and look around your families and know what's going on with electronics. It gets bigger and bigger with each passing day. It's really not, and none of those commodities belong in the waste stream. Historically, we've just thrown them in a garbage can and recognize that they're going to our burn facilities, to our processing plants, to our compost facilities, our landfills. None of those places does this waste material belong. It's a hazardous element, which really is what started this discussion, quite frankly. We recognize that in every unit there are many different kind of items that are either very recyclable or harmful to the environment, and we want to end that practice if we can. And we offer here a solution which has been crafted over hundreds of hours, over many skilled individuals. One of them seated next to me today, and we hope that we have a reasonable solution to this problem. It's a government-light alternative. We recognize that there's relatively little governmental support that necessarily will go into this. The costs that they may incur will be supported by manufacturers' fees. We're really asking the manufacturers who are in business today, who are helping to create these commodities and put them into the marketplace, to help us solve this problem. We're talking about product stewardship, which you probably talk about here in other arenas. We're talking about manufacturer responsibility. We're talking about partnering, what counties and governments do with manufacturers to help find a solution to this problem. A transition for only a moment. For one of the items that we'll have some discussions, a question regarding what the proper ratio is. Today all the buzz in the halls kind of is what's the right ratio in relationship to how much you sell and how much you recycle. We started out with the bill, as pointed out by Representative Saylor, that was kind of 1-to-1. You sell a pound, you recycle a pound. We modified that a little bit to recognize maybe that was high, and so we adjusted that to 0.8. There's some reasons why so many of us, including the Swim Club, AMC, the Retail Association, Solid Waste Administrators, the Sierra Club, the Clean Water Action, Best Buy, and I'm missing a whole bunch of partners, many of them who are here today, still support that 0.08 position. Why? One of the first ones is that we do not want to go into this discussion, which is years overdue in my estimation. Sure. We don't want to be scrambling around in the end, having homeowners bring us commodities and not have the resources to manage that material. And we believe that at 0.08, that will accomplish that. We recognize that the life expectancy of electronics continues to compress. It gets shorter and shorter. TVs used to last 20 years. Today they last 7. You're out looking for one reason or another for a new one. There's a pent-up demand that we've talked about a moment ago and talked about it again and again. I can look around in this room, I'm sure, and recognize people have these items in their garages and basements and so on, and we anticipate that when we're given the opportunity to get rid of those materials at a convenient and free alternative, that they will, and that there will be a heavy influx of material in the early days of this program. The other part of it is, you can argue about 1-to-1, but today, what they're selling today weighs 1/2 or 1/3 as much as items that were sold years ago. I mean, think about the computer screen that used to sit on your desk and weigh 15 pounds. Today it's a flat panel screen and you can move it with one hand. It's very different today. So the ratio of what they're getting in is far heavier than what they're selling today. So we think that we're pretty close to that target, quite frankly. The other part of it is that as we think about ever reducing the goal, we begin to think about reducing the amount of effort that manufacturers will put in to collecting electronics beyond the metropolitan boundaries. We have 87 counties in this state, and only 7 of them are represented in this surrounding here. And yet we want manufacturers to be driven and motivated to find opportunities and create opportunities throughout Minnesota to get that discarded commodity to market. And I know that Ted Trilene and others certainly recognize that problem and support that. The money goes into a special fund. Even if we missed our target and we're beyond it, clearly our bill, and I was reading it moments ago, describes how those dollars will go back the following 1 year later to readjust the goal. We readjust the sales ratios, we readjust the formula, we readjust just the weight considerations. So undoubtedly, we would adjust for that in a variety of ways to satisfy that once again by resetting those goals. It's pointed out, too, that we do anticipate a further influx in only 09, I think, when we switched from analog to digital. And I don't know what most of the homeowners will do, but I know many of them will be chasing over to an electronics entity to purchase a new TV set, either because there's no longer works adequately or that the marketplace has changed enough that they have new opportunities that they didn't have before. It'll only grow the problem. And with that, I'll stand for any comments.
Thank you. I think we'll wait for questions till the end. Thank you very much for coming. Good remarks.
Thank you very much.
Emily Garland.
Madam Chair, I spoke with Annalee, and she, you know, representing counties, but since we had two folks already, you know, talking in that regard, just to, you know, in the interest of saving time for your committee, she will stand for any questions, and unless there was, you know, something else that you would like to hear from her at this point in time.
And I would like, no, thank you, and thank you for being here and able to answer questions, if I know you can. Judy Cook from Hewlett-Packard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Hill Girard Associates, representing Hewlett-Packard today. Hewlett-Packard has a longstanding commitment to collection and recycling of used electronics. They will soon reach £1 billion recycled. I'll repeat that, a billion. As a leader in recycling of used electronics, Hewlett-Packard is on record all over the country supporting manufacturer responsibility legislation. Unfortunately, we cannot support this bill because of the method in which the manufacturer responsibility is determined, which is a market share approach. Hewlett-Packard promotes a return share approach, which bases manufacturer's responsibility on how much used electronics consumers return for recycling rather than how much consumers purchase, which has no correlation to what is in the waste stream today. For purposes of today's discussion regarding the fiscal impact of this legislation, we suggest that it's important for you to understand all of the variables in this market share bill and the significant revenue that will be raised well above and beyond the state's needs for managing used electronics. I'd like to focus on the variable fee, or what manufacturers consider to be a very significant penalty that is paid if they don't meet the required ratio in the bill of recycling 0.8 pounds of e-waste for every 1 pound sold. The bill currently includes a formula that will raise significant revenue beyond what is needed. At the 0.8-to-1 ratio, there's a windfall of millions of dollars to the state. Using information provided by the PCA, in 2004, approximately 38,814,870 pounds of covered electronics were sold in Minnesota. The 2008 expected collection of covered electronics is 23,230,75 pounds. They are assuming a rate of 42 pounds per capita return, which is in far excess of the rate of 1.2 pounds per capita in California, which has a very significant program and has extensive promotion of that program. But using the 3.42 pounds, let's assume we do get that, the result is a 15,584,000 pound difference, which at 50 cents per pound results in a penalty of nearly $7.8 million. This is what manufacturers will be required to pay. It is built into this bill after they've spent probably $9 million or more to collect the used electronics the consumers return. Let me restate this. Using the PCA numbers, if the manufacturers collect and recycle every ounce of used electronics that we can realistically anticipate to get back, which will cost them probably around $9 million, they will still face a penalty somewhere in the neighborhood upwards of $7 million a year. Now, we hear a lot about the ratio and the weight, but I want to see some numbers. These are the first numbers we've seen. Now, some are arguing that the weight of products is decreasing. Certainly, we are seeing an explosion in the purchase of items, and the size is increasing. So I think until we see numbers, that would be the appropriate time to determine what the right ratio is. I would suggest that if history is any indicator, much of this money will not be appropriated to the PCA for e-waste efforts by the legislature, but will go into the general fund, and I don't think I need to remind everybody on this committee how that's happened in the past. Another finance-related issue is the grant program established in the bill. The stated intention of this program is to assist e-waste collection and recycling efforts in rural counties. However, this grant program actually guarantees that manufacturers will fail. In this bill, the money that the legislature appropriates from the e-waste fund is to be used for grants to private entities and counties outside the 11-county metro area. This means that others, including private entities, will be funded through manufacturer penalty money to run programs that compete with manufacturers, take that product out of the waste stream, thereby making less product available for the manufacturers to collect, seriously hampering their ability to reach their goal and thereby increasing the penalty. While this may not be the intention, the result has a significant negative impact for manufacturers. And I remind you, these are manufacturers who are trying to do the right thing by running programs and collecting the used electronics that consumers return. Ideally, Hewlett-Packard would encourage you to consider a return share approach because we do support manufacturers' responsibility. But that does not rely on the multiples of estimates that are completely determined by consumer behavior. And as currently drafted, this bill is a significant revenue generator, well beyond the needs to collect and recycle used electronics, and also contains serious competitive issues for manufacturers. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. I don't see any questions, but one representative copy.
I have a question for the author. Is it?
Let's take the questions to the author now.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Saylor, I asked this in another committee, and I guess I never got what I was looking for as an answer. If we're looking at Hennepin County, who has the Cadillac plan, and the state of California, and I don't remember the figure off the top of my head, but has a similar plan, and they're getting 30% or in that neighborhood of waste being recycled, is it realistic for us to expect people to return things at such a higher volume? And I know, Madam Chair, we had this discussion about things in people's basements and advertising and things like that, but I'm just wondering if this is a necessary bill. I mean, everybody wants to get rid of e-waste, but is this necessary and is it realistic?
Madam Chair, Representative Hoppe, yes, we've heard a number of those concerns in the past. Actually, there's the fact that people say that Hennepin County is the Cadillac. It is in many regards, but even some of their numbers are certainly subject to dispute. One thing I would like to mention is the fact that Hennepin County has been accepting electronic waste, but they have not been promoting them. And that's certainly the case throughout the rest of the state of Minnesota. Counties have not been out there advertising to the population that they want them to bring these things in. And so when you look at numbers that come from Hennepin County, they're based on the fact that they're just taking in what people bring them. There is no advertising, to my knowledge, that they're asking people to bring them in now. And so there is a great deal of pent-up waste out there. It seems like every time I come to one of these hearings, I talk to someone else, or they come and talk to me, and they say, oh, yeah, that's right. You know, and sure enough, it happened this morning, another staffer. Oh, I have a great big old monitor, but now I have all laptops in the house. And I guess it's just saying the same thing over, but I'm always amazed that there's a new person every single time we bring up e-waste that has a moment of confession of what's in the basement. But at any rate, further, if he had any further questions about that, Trudy Richter would also, I think, be able to speak to that.
We can take one more quick question, and then Representative Moe has a question.
Thank you. And along the same line, was there any reason for picking 80%? Is that I mean, is there any data or basis for picking that, or is it just a hope?
Madam Chair and Representative Hoppe, I think I'll have Trudy Richter speak to that as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Trudy Richter. I'm here on behalf of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board. The original one-to-one ratio was set by actually a bipartisan task force last year when they developed this. Since that time, we felt it was appropriate to adjust it down to 0.8. We think there are many reasons why 0.8 is the correct number. We know that others think there are many reasons why it is not. I do know that the number in California is other than what was represented. It's much closer to the number we're hoping to gain with our program here at 0.8. And we know, for instance, as Hennepin County recycling of CRTs in the last year went up 14%. We know their numbers don't include all the private collectors that are in the metro area. We know their numbers also do not include the remaining metro counties that have not had programs in place. So we truly do believe there is demand. And with the change in 2009 when TVs change and CRTs disappear, my understanding is that will reduce the total sales by over 18 million pounds at that time. It's important that we keep the ratio high for the number to successfully gather the amount that will be recycled. Thank you.
Thank you. We have, I think, two quick questions left. I'm reminded again that Representative Magnus has guests in town today, and he did want them to be able to appear before us. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be brief. First off, Representative Ann Zelson and I were arguing as to whose district those pictures were taken in, whether mine or his. You could tell us that later. My question is about the Hewlett-Packard model manufacturer-based collection. It's the bill before us, and maybe the author would be the best person to answer. The bill before us is looking to collect 80% of the sold. How many percent is the manufacturer's model? So if we were to say, you know, let's put on that hat, Hewlett-Packard has this manufacturer's, like, I know that they sell a lot of computers, but it seems to me that there's probably a large percentage of the e-waste that's not Hewlett-Packard. So maybe you can compare and contrast the total collection for those two models.
Madam Chair and Representative Moe, they're using a different model, and so we can't really compare the two very well with that. And but what we really are trying to make sure that we do is be sure that the overall overriding concern is that the counties and cities that are ending up with all of this are able to have enough wherewithal to set up the programs in the first year, and then to make sure that in following years that we basically true up, we make sure that there's no intent to collect additional money that's not a money maker for the counties. The counties would be more than happy to never have to deal with e-waste again if it were at all possible. But at any rate, so we're just trying to be certain that we have a viable means there for the counties and cities to deal with this waste.
Madam Chair, I just my point was that I think the problem is far larger than just Hewlett-Packard computers. And that would have been my point. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Packbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Saylor, it might not be a moneymaker for the counties, but it sure is a moneymaker for the state. And as long as this is the Finance Committee, Madam Chair, and we're talking about state government handling this project and doling out the money and collecting money, I'd like to hear from the MPCA and have them tell us about how much, is it their intent to have this thing be a moneymaker? Is it, did they want this to just collect enough money to handle the program, or are they looking to collect additional money for this? And what are they going to do with that money? Is there anybody here from the MPCA that can come down and answer that question?
Respond to Representative Packard's question.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Dunn. I'm with the Pollution Control Agency and have been following and involved in the discussions as long as County Commissioner Kordiak on trying to figure out ways to deal with this issue. Representative Hatbrock, Madam Chair, it is not the intention of the Pollution Control Agency, nor is it the intention of most of the parties that I'm aware of that are involved in this issue, to use this as a revenue-raising mechanism, and would be thrilled, I think, along with everybody else, if no additional penalties or premiums were paid and that all of the e-waste that was generated in the state of Minnesota was adequately collected and recycled. So it is not conceived to be a mechanism to raise revenue at all.
Thank you, Mr.
Madam Chair. But by the MPCO's own numbers, it is going to bring in more money than is going to be needed to run the program. And I'm wondering what's going to happen to that money and why that hasn't been advised and the bill changed to accommodate that.
Mr. Dunn, do you have a response you'd like to make?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Hackbarth, the agency, as of 5 o'clock yesterday, was still receiving data from the manufacturers and the groups of manufacturers. We're still evaluating what an appropriate ratio should be. There are other mechanisms that are possibly out there and available to ensure that this, in fact, will not be a revenue-raising mechanism. One of the thoughts that has been discussed is should there be a cap placed on the amount of revenues that would come in, or should the fee be a variable fee, not a flat 50 cents per pound, but something graded based upon performance of a manufacturer. We're still exploring some of those possibilities, and perhaps at a later point in time, it would be appropriate to have those discussions with authors and others, and perhaps they could be incorporated. But it is not the intent to make this a revenue cash cow for the state.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Representative Duncan, do you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question to Mr. Dunn. It seems to me that logically that you will have a record of how much was recycled the first year, and you could self-adjust the 0.8 to some other number if it wasn't that much the second year. Is that what your intentions are?
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, there are provisions in the bill that require that the agency on an annual basis evaluate what the returns are and what the sales are and what the premiums are that have been paid in and recommend to the legislature that these adjustments have been made. One of the things we've attempted to do in order to continue to make this a government-like function is not to have to go through administrative rule adoption processes, and I believe that if we were to do this on an annual basis, that would require that we go through some type of rule process, which would be expensive, lengthy, and open to all kinds of contention.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. I don't see any other questions. Representative Gartner, will you renew your motion?
Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 854, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
No.
The motion carries. The bill is forward to the Committee on Finance. Thank you, Representative Saylor, and also thank you, Representative Osment. There's so much weight to get this work done. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. And I add my thanks as well to Representative Osment, who I think everyone in this room knows did so much work to get this going. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Representative Knight.
I'm sure Representative Magnus is coming up. Maybe I need a little help before the next meeting just talking about committee jurisdiction and debate and discussion on what's policy and what's finance and where we maybe talk about policy and where we talk about finance with committees. We're starting to run into a number of bills here now, and I anticipate the number will increase, and it might be good to have, we don't need to do it today, but just something about that.
I think that's a good idea, Representative Hanson. We will follow up on that, but today, and right now, we're going to hear from Representative Max.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for allowing us the hearing today. Madam Chair, I would move House File 45 for possible inclusion in the omnibus environment finance bill.
Thank you. If you'll proceed, we are running over time. There were more questions about e-waste than I anticipated.
That's fine, Madam Chair. I'll be as brief as we can. Back in 1978, the legislature created several organizations like the Area 2 Minnesota River Basin organization. This organization is made up of nine counties. It represents seven legislative districts. Representative Peterson, Representative Coonan, Representative Finstead, Hamilton, Cornish, Seifert, and myself. So it does encompass quite an area. We're doing our best to hold back the waters and hold back nutrients and pollutants from the Minnesota River and on to the Mississippi River. We're hoping that outcome would be that we reduce the pollution in the Lake Pepin watershed and all as we go. So, Madam Chair, I think this is an important bill for us to look at and do our best to find ways to reduce the contaminations in the various levels as we go across the state. Madam Chair, today I have with me Carrie Netsky with the Region Area 2 project to testify. I would point out also, as we looked at initial funding for this, it's dropped through the years. Back in 1989, several years ago, we were cut to $189,000. It is a 75% and 25% match. And at that level, the counties are putting in $47,000 plus dollars into that to make it a 25% level. With the cuts we've experienced down to $140,000, and then as a result of the $4.5 billion shortfall a few years ago went down to $105,000, the counties felt strongly enough about the program to continue the funding at that level, and so really their match now is about 45%, not the original 25%. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Carrie.
Thank you, Representative Magnuson. Madam Chair, good morning. Again, my name is Carrie Netsky. I'm the coordinator for Area 2 Minnesota River Basin Projects Incorporated, and we're based out of Marshall, Minnesota. Rather than going through my testimony, which I fear the shortage of time, the back of your packet, there's a yellow sheet, and I do have the typewritten of what I plan to present today. But rather than going through that, I will just kind of hit a few of the highlights that will be more important to you. As Representative Magnuson summarized, we have a 29-year history with the state of Minnesota being created by statute for flood damage reduction projects. The cover of your packet that was presented to you, there's a little map of Minnesota and there's a big black blotch there. Those are the counties that Area 2 represents. We also encompass part of South Dakota. As you realize, a lot of our flooding problems in the Southwest do stem from South Dakota. Area 2's approach to flood control over the last 29 years has been to basically stop the water where it falls, and we create our retention projects in a stair-step fashion down the Buffalo Ridge, also known as the Catoda Prairie. The Buffalo Ridge, you also know for the wind turbine generators that they are locating upon it for wind generation or electric generation. The Buffalo Ridge, which a lot of people don't realize, has got a dramatic elevation difference. In the Lopapaw River watershed, which is part of the Area 2 watershed, we have elevation drops of 80 feet per mile. When you get closer to the Redwood Falls area, you're looking at 50 feet per mile. When you compare this to the Red River Valley, they have a few feet per mile. So you can see that our flooding problems are very different from the Red River problems. Our water comes down very fast, becomes very erosive, and causes dramatic damage on an annual basis. If I could refer you to page 1 of your handout, the bottom two pictures is a three-main stabilization project that we completed 2 years ago. And it just gives you an idea of just what these erosive waters can do, and they're very common, or scenes like this are very common in our part of the state. Our approach allows for landowner-friendly and voluntary solutions to this problem. We try to keep the water where it falls. We try to keep the stream banks where they belong, to keep those nutrients and sediments where they belong and not in our already impaired waters for the state. Area 2 is very different in that it also has a secondary form of flooding, not just from the elevation difference, but it's called crossover flooding.
due to the topography, not only do the floodwaters flow from southwest to northeast towards the Minnesota River, our watershed is also tipped towards the southeast. So when the flooding becomes real strong, the floodwaters can actually jump watersheds. But Baca Prado will go into the Yellow Medicine. The Yellow Medicine waters will go into the Redwood and all the way down to Mankato. So our flooding dilemmas are twofold when you look at it that way. The real reason I'm here today is, again, for our administrative funding. I'll ask you to flip one more page in your booklet. There's a graph which basically shows you everything you need to know. This is a graphical representation of what we have received in funding for the last 10 years. In yellow is the administrative funding for our office. The other colors in the background are other project funding for actually constructing our projects, representing bonding, LCMR, and other capital budget funding. As Mr. Representative Magus had mentioned, that through the years we've had dramatic cuts, primarily during the Ventura administration when there was cuts to literally every department and organization in the state. We were at a stable funding of $189,000 a year, with that funding matched by about $83,000 contributed by the 9-member counties. We were able to run our office of 2 full-time employees and also build projects. Back in 2001, we had a 25% cut down to $140,000. We were at that level for 2 years. After that, we were actually slated for zero funding, as were all joint powers organizations from the state of Minnesota. We were only of the three that joint powers that remain today and do receive some level of funding from the state of Minnesota. We were able, through legislation, to restore our funding to a level of $105,000, where we have remained level for 4 years. As you can tell, that getting at that level from where we were has been a significant challenge for us. But we have abided, and we continue to perform and do our projects as intended by statute. What we are asking is that we can be increased back to that $140,000 level. We realize that money is tight and there's a lot of needs in the state, but this is also a very proven, successful relationship that we've had with the state of Minnesota for 29 years now. The one other comment I wanted to make before I cease my comments is that the 9-member counties that belong to Area 2 have proven their commitment. As Representative Banks mentioned, they contribute about $82,000 a year, which is actually the 25% match to the $189,000 level. When all these cuts started happening, to the 140 and to the 105, those 9 counties remained at that same $82,000 level. They did not choose to reduce their contributions simply because of the cuts. Just this last fiscal year, they did increase it by another 2%, so now it's up to about $85,000 versus the state share of 105. So just to let you know, I apologize, my board of directors were unable to come due to our blizzards last weekend. A lot of meetings were rescheduled, including our own board of directors meeting that they're having today without me, which is a little fearful. Anyway, I'm here, and I appreciate having this opportunity to talk to you, and please feel free to go through those booklets at your leisure.
Well, we appreciate your coming. I think everybody on this committee realizes that work is done on the local level, and folks here appreciate that work. There is no question about it. However, we do not have any money in the governor's budget specifically for projects like this. So any money would have to come from a reallocation from someplace else. So you just have to keep that in mind.
Thank you very much.
You have one question, and I think we are going to adjourn, but we will lay this over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment and a quick question for the author. I used to swim in the Minnesota River as a kid, and based on what we know about it, it's amazing about brain cancer and all. But looking at it now compared to then, the river has been cleaned up measurably, and we appreciate your work. And just one question for the author. Does the Land Stewardship Project support this legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Moore, I'm not certain, but Bowser does, and the Bowser executive here thinks it's great. You'll have to ask Representative Peterson.
I'm not sitting in the middle of this, so I'm going to ask Representative Hackforth if he has raised his hand.
Madam Chair, I think this item is already in the budget, just that this bill is at a little higher rate. Mm-hmm. It is already in the budget.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Any members?
A higher rate. We lay it over. It's now laid over for inclusion, for possible inclusion.
I see no other questions from me, members in the meeting.